Did you know?
Publicly available information is one of the main information sources for law enforcement and intelligence agencies.
Open source intelligence practitioners use publicly available data from a fitness tracking app to identify and map military bases around the world.
And terrorists used Google Earth imagery to plan their attacks on British bases in Basra in the 2000s.
This is Tech Against Terrorism. I'm Adam Hadley.
And I'm Laurent Bodo.
In this episode, we're taking a closer look at the fight behind the screens. We'll explore the role of open source intelligence, also called OSINT. We'll explain what it is and how we at Tech Against Terrorism are using it to inform our work. We'll also be talking to a number of leading experts in this field.
At Tech Against Terrorism, open source intelligence is central to our work. Tackling terrorist exploitation of the internet requires a thorough understanding of the past and current threat pictures. To that end, OSINT helps us to find answers to the what, where, when, why, and how questions, but also to explain certain phenomena or make predictions and forecasts with regards to what terrorists might be up to next on the internet.
Open source intelligence, OSINT, focuses on understanding publicly available information and analysing that in the context of intelligence assessments. In an intelligence context, open source intelligence, or OSINT, is regarded as one of the main intelligence disciplines, alongside human intelligence, or HUMINT, which gathers information from people on the ground, or signals intelligence, or SIGINT, which is concerned with collecting information from electronic signals. Furthermore, one challenge with OSINT is understanding when OSINT moves into HUMINT, when interaction with individuals starts becoming more of a human intelligence activity versus an open source intelligence activity.
At Tech Against Terrorism, we use OSINT to inform our work that centers around three main pillars: tech sector outreach, knowledge sharing, and operational support. Past examples of our OSINT work include descriptive analysis of terror attacks and the tech sector response, where we highlight important gaps in current global efforts. But we also use various OSINT tools and techniques to identify and reach out to owners of small tech platforms in order to help them tackle terrorist exploitation of their services.
The main advantage of open source intelligence is that it's available for everyone to collect and analyse. OSINT is drawn from publicly available sources, mainly the internet, but also traditional media such as newspapers and radio.
A global increase in internet usage and technological advancements have led to an explosion of publicly available information, and it still continues to grow. Given this information overload, you need to know how and where to find the missing piece in your puzzle. There are special tools and techniques you can use, but OSINT is not only about how to use these tools and techniques. It is more about critical thinking, connecting the dots, while utilizing a robust methodology to overcome cognitive biases when processing large amounts of information and making judgments in your analysis.
When considering open source intelligence, it's important not just to focus on the collection discipline itself. It's also critical to understand how traditional approaches from intelligence analysis can be applied to turn information into intelligence.
Now, let's explore the fight behind the screens. We are delighted to welcome and introduce Nico, aka Dutch OSINT Guy. Nico is an all-source analyst specialized in open-source intelligence and online human intelligence. He spent over 20 years at Dutch law enforcement and worked on numerous murder, international narcotics, gang violence, and terrorism cases, just to name a few. Nico, welcome to our podcast, and thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you for having me.
So, my first question would be, given your background and vast amount of experience, can you tell us a little bit about how you have used open-source intelligence in your investigations?
Wow, that's a really broad question. I think I've used like the whole palette which you can use within open source intelligence for counterterrorism cases, but also narcotics cases. So almost 15 years ago, I started exploring especially how it can be used for counterterrorism. So first I did some studies on where certain groups manifest themselves and how to copy or at least mimic their behavior and their digital footprint so I can blend in. And from there I just went in deeper and deeper and always trying to stay at least not ahead of them, but at least keep the same pace as those certain groups are having online and learning what they are learning at that moment to, for instance, blur themselves out online to get identified. So it was a constant learning process instead of always investigating. It almost blends in learning and investigating those groups.
You mentioned to blend in. So how difficult is it in general to follow these groups and to blend in and mimic their behavior online?
Well, during my governmental background within law enforcement, it was way harder because most governments only work from 9 to 5, and I had to fight a really long and hard fight within the government to convince leadership on flexible working hours, but also on getting a flexible hardware setup as well as a flexible software setup to have a good digital fingerprint which doesn't stand out or at least blends in. And for instance, to work during the weekend or late at night or early in the morning, because that's not standard procedure within a lot of governments. So I think that was the most difficult part initially, to get involved in this online hunting down of certain groups.
Absolutely. For researchers or anyone who wants to use open source intelligence to research these entities online, what do you think in terms of ethical considerations?
Yeah, it depends on the goal. If you want to prevent a terrorist attack like we had in Europe the last years a lot, I would, from my gut, I would say by all means necessary. But it all depends on how much are you willing to violate the privacy of individuals who you come across during the tracking down of the actual people who are willing to pick up arms or at least hurt others. Because not all in that investigative process will pick up arms or will be prepared to use violence against others. So how far are you willing to go and find them? So initially, I would say try and stay in the open source field at all costs. So no infiltrating, no hacking, no luring with certain tokens, for instance. Just find the perpetrators in the open.
And before you get stuck into the collect stage of this, how do you go about planning your work?
It's all about doing your homework, I guess. So initially you'll get a report, or someone calls into law enforcement or makes a statement online about a certain group preparing something, or they have a certain interest. So what I do is just gather as much as possible background information about that individual or group and try and find pivot points to answer my research question. So initially, it all starts with defining a good research question, and a question and an answer like "give me everything about this person and group" just isn't a good refined research question. If you ask me, are they planning an attack, or where are they currently living at this moment? Those are questions I, as an open source intelligence gatherer and analyst, can try and answer. So, yeah, I'll study their logos. I'll study where they manifest themselves online. I'll study which context they have, or maybe they do not have, and I want to have insight to. So it's all about doing a firm background check and coming up with good answerable research questions, if you ask me.
So that's really interesting, saying that it's all about asking the right questions in the first place. We hear a lot about the intelligence cycle, which to listeners maybe not familiar with that concept, focuses on first thinking through collection and then collation, analysis and dissemination. So where is your work focused typically? Because of course I know you do lots of collection, but how do you turn that into interesting analysis and assessment?
I think when you grab a hold of the basics and try and answer those basic, which I like to call golden W's, the who, the where, the what, the when, you will almost always will find the answer to your research question. And maybe in addition, if you find those specific indicators which answer your question, for instance, if I'm looking for a person's home, I will also always try and find the exact same answer in another source. Say, for instance, I find a suspect's address on Facebook, I will also try and find that exact same address on another platform not being Facebook. So it could be Twitter, it could be Instagram, it could be Open Corporates, it could be whatever, just to verify and validate that the initial source is correct.
And how do you deal with regulatory considerations? Here in the United Kingdom, there's the Investigatory Powers Act, of course, the GDPR, and there are thoughts about personally identifiable information. How do you deal with that challenge?
Well, until now, it hasn't been that challenging on not finding the information anymore. It's more about how do we preserve the information for later analysis. So I think that's becoming more and more a problem, especially when you look into the terrorism and counterterrorism field, because certain groups have time and they have a lot of time. For instance, when you look at jihadis, for instance, they will have years and years to plan their attack, build their network. And when you look at GDPR, it forbids you to store and collect certain information for a longer period, which makes it, in essence, impossible for me to keep track of certain terrorist groups. So I think for certain research cases, there should be like an exception or a reconsideration for these laws that are implemented.
Understood. And in terms of understanding the terrorist use of the internet, which platforms do you focus on and why?
Initially, I would like to state I would look at the open platforms, which are fairly easily accessible for each and everyone. For instance, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, VK.com. Because still my opinion is if you want to spread a certain thought or if you want to gain global acceptance, you want to be heard. And you want to propagate your mission statement on those platforms where the vast majority is present at. So it wouldn't make sense if they want to reach my mother, for instance, to do it on a closed Telegram group because she won't be there. So I will initially look at all the open, globally accepted social media platforms. And from that, I will try and pivot in and go deeper and deeper and go back to the source where they initially spread the information or propaganda.
Well, first of all, I'd hope that your mother isn't vulnerable to radicalization by terrorists, but maybe that's
I hope so too.
A slightly separate point.
She's probably vulnerable to shopping terrorists.
So, Nico, when researching terrorists or generally speaking malicious actors online, what role does operational security play? Can you explain what it is and why everyone should know about it?
I think it's key if you take your job serious, because the other side, the adversary, will look at you and there's a risk involved in there. I know for a fact that jihadi groups leave canary tokens. It's a technical term for if you're looking in certain servers, they will know. It's like those little, you can compare them with little mouse traps. They will get alerted when someone is poking around in a certain area. But they will also look at your online fingerprint. For instance, if you only visit a certain website or platform between governmental hours, working hours, they will try and determine if you are one of them or not, or they will ask questions. So you should have an alibi, you should have a good machine which doesn't leave a trace back to, for instance, your police station or your secret servers or IP addresses. So before you do any research, you should harden your system. You should always think of what's my research question and what's the risk involved. So if you are looking into only Facebook groups, the chance of leaving your fingerprint to, let's say, the hate group involved, it's way less than leaving your fingerprint on their personal website, because then the administrator can determine your device IP address as well as your browser fingerprint and all. But when looking on a closed social media platform, it's way harder for them to determine. Then it would be based on behavior or maybe having not hardened your browser for exploits, for instance, when you're looking into hacker groups. So I think it's key. It all starts with thinking of operational security and also what the adversary might learn or know by the way you move online.
It sounds like preparation is key to this. I wonder what advice you'd have for people who want to get started with open source intelligence.
If you really want to get started, don't get started in looking at hackers or terrorists, because they are the hardcore types and they know how to look back at you. Try and look for not that kind of risky things. Try things like QuizTime, which you have online. So it's just basic reverse image searching of image and trying to geolocate certain things. Just get the hang of those things. Read up on blogs on operational security, for instance, and learn from that. There's a lot of blogging on that. But also there's a lot of background information on how to harden browsers or behave online. So don't immediately jump in doing online research.
Yeah, and I think I should add from us at Tech Against Terrorism to listeners is a bit of a disclaimer that, yeah, there's a lot of risk associated with open source intelligence, and it's imperative that people starting out on this really understand the law and understand the kind of regulations that apply to this, because there is quite a bit of risk in our view, and it does require a substantial amount of training to get it right.
Yeah, agreed. Yeah, for instance, if you're really interested, for instance, in people trading malicious viruses, and you immediately go on the dark web or the Tor browser, you might expose your whole company to viruses, for instance, or crypto lockers, just because you don't know what risks are involved with that.
And even in the UK, even viewing terrorist content is potentially a criminal activity. So there are kind of all sorts of laws that apply to this that perhaps people new to this area might not be familiar with.
Yeah, good point. Yeah, that's absolutely true. Also counts for child abuse things. You might get exposed to certain information which is just illegal in your country. Yeah.
And on that, how do you, if you come across material or communications that suggests imminent threat to life, what would you do about this?
I would always try to inform the local involved authorities or maybe the nation state's intelligence firms. It all depends on the case, I guess. But when it comes to threatening lives or imminent threat, I will always try and inform those bodies who need to be informed.
Great. Well, thanks very much for hearing from you today. Keep up the good work. It sounds like you're having a big impact in this area.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
If you want to read more about Nico's work, we will put all the links in the show notes and make sure to follow him on Twitter. His handle is @Dutch_OSINTGuy. Now let's explore the role of OSINT and see how it is being used in different contexts. Our next guest is Benjamin Strick. Ben is an open source investigator for BBC Africa Eye, Bellingcat contributor, and an instructor in arms tracing, geospatial intelligence, and network analysis. He has worked on the implementation of OSINT techniques in investigative journalism in award-winning BBC Africa Eye productions, including Anatomy of a Killing, Sudan's Secret Hit Squads, and Sudan's Livestream Massacre. Ben, welcome to the Tech Against Terrorism podcast, and thank you for taking the time.
Thank you for having me.
So, Ben, can you tell us a little bit more about your work at BBC Africa Eye and how you use OSINT?
Sure, Laurent. So with BBC Africa Eye, we're a very small investigative unit, and we work with hundreds, if not thousands, of freelancers throughout Africa. We focus on the areas that journalists can't often get to, and where reporting on the ground is quite difficult, and sometimes the narrative is skewed. We use open source in respect of that because oftentimes we can't get on the ground. And these are circumstances such as where Boko Haram and Islamic State of West Africa may be operating, where ethnic wars and ethnic cleansing is happening as well. It's a very dangerous and difficult environment to report from. So we often use, we work with locals, we work with local journalists, and we use a lot of open source to try and navigate our way through the facts to really tell what happens on the ground.
So you mentioned that sometimes reporting is very difficult or challenging, and this is one of the reasons why you use open sources. Can you name some of the challenges that you encounter?
Yeah, for our working environment, specifically in Africa, oftentimes we'll have circumstances where the government may cut the internet, for instance. And so this happened in Sudan recently after a massacre that happened on June 3rd this year. So it's quite difficult to get that information out to people like us to investigate. And then we also have the limitations of just digital literacy in general. Some of these really remote villages that are in the subprime area of an ethnic war aren't really on Facebook. People aren't tagging themselves at a restaurant and taking photos and videos. So it's navigating our way from the scant material that is available to really try and paint a picture of what's going on the ground.
So Ben, your OSINT work is quite different, as in contrast to other lines of work where OSINT is utilized. especially in the sense that you try hold those responsible for accounts who committed these atrocities. As I mentioned in the introduction, you worked on investigations such as Anatomy of a Killing and Sudan's secret hit squads. Can you elaborate on either of these?
So for open source in general, whether it be BBC Africa Eye, with Bellingcat, or with my own personal investigations, I always use open source to hold those responsible to account. And I think it's about making an impact. So for instance, for Anatomy of a Killing, which is the Cameroonian story of the two women and children that were executed in the far north of Cameroon, when this initially came out on Twitter, the government said it was fake news. They said that the people responsible were not Cameroonian soldiers. They didn't use those sort of weapons in that Sahelian region. We were able to use open source in a crowdsourced team to debunk exactly what the government said and find that actually those responsible for the murders were part of the Cameroon military. And it really went against what that sort of fake news statement from the ministers said. I think this is an important part of open source, is that we're pivoting on information and not just gathering a heap of facts, but we're diving into a story to navigate what the facts exactly are and tell the truth of what happened in a certain circumstance. And that's a really good case study for that.
So creating genuine impact, is this one of your motivations of why you do this type of work?
For me, impact is the most important thing. It's not about money, it's not about job title or anything like that. It's about really trying to help those that actually need it and try and affect policies if you can and try and actually get some airtime in government about things that matter. And that's why impact matters.
You also mentioned collaboration. How important is that when working on these investigations?
I think collaboration is the most important thing you could ever have. It makes you so much stronger. In the intelligence field, a lot of people believe in the siloing effect. So they silo their information, they keep it to themselves, they don't really share, and they try and work on an investigation like that. It's tiresome, it's not as strong, and it's just not as effective as working with a team. Because this is open source information, it's not classified, it's not confidential, we can share it with whoever we want. And for instance, Laurent, I've worked with you on many investigations that I would not have been capable of with the findings whatsoever, but I've worked with you on them, and we've been so much stronger as a team. And it's also stopping that burnout as well. You can't save the world yourself. You can't have that impact yourself. But if you work with so many of the people that are keen in the open source community that have niche skills in different areas, speak different languages, recognize different weapon systems, have different strengths in geospatial imagery, you're so much more effective in taking on those that are actually responsible for some of the big things that are happening in the world.
I absolutely agree. I mean, at Tech Against Terrorism, we also collaborate with many, many stakeholders on different things. And when it comes to our OSINT work, we also engage and collaborate with researchers and other entities that collect relevant information that can inform our work. So moving on to the slightly darker corners of the internet and talking more about terrorist use of the internet, the dark web is often mentioned with regards to terrorist use of the internet. So can you tell us a little bit about that? Have you done any work in this field?
Yeah, so in looking at a lot of the content online, obviously I focus on networks of people, whether they be soldiers, whether they be jihadist individuals, whether they be far right. At the moment, there is a huge shift in most of these networks pushing towards going to not clear web areas or platforms or forums. And they're pushing towards places on the dark web because they can communicate freely, they can post whatever they like, there's less censorship. It's more of a freedom of speech thing as well. And so in having a look at these dark web platforms, as well as hidden platforms on Telegram, for instance, more anonymous-based platforms, in looking at these sorts of areas, we can notice a quite an increase in the communication that is happening there, the sharing of content. And also, for me, what I find the most interesting is the sharing about adapting to technology and adapting to the parameters and policies that social media platforms are putting in. When, for instance, we're looking at cryptocurrencies for jihadists, on some of the forums that I'm actually looking at, ethically, we're noticing that whenever there's, a policy update in one of the cryptocurrency exchanges, for instance, Coinbase, the users will post information on these dark web forums saying, here's how to avoid this policy that's been put in place by this platform. And I think that's pretty interesting because they're an organic environment that's adapting to policies put in place to stop directly them.
You mentioned adaption, and this is also what we can see, and this is also why we use open source intelligence to monitor activities, certain activities, to inform our work, because this is the relevant information that we are after, that shift moving on to slightly darker corners of the internet or to other websites, to other platforms, how they start using this platform or even different technologies. And especially what you also mentioned with regards to avoiding these new policies that were implemented. This is all very important and also very relevant to our work. So Ben, in your latest work, you have discovered a bot network that has intentionally spread disinformation across several social media platforms to influence politics in West Papua. So that was really interesting to read. And my question is, how have you discovered it and how did you go about researching it?
For the first part of your question, having a look at the discovery. So I was initially going through footage that was uploaded on social media about an attack that happened on a specific date when the internet was cut or limited in West Papua and that area. And so I was having a look on Twitter, for instance, where a lot of the videos were being uploaded, and they were all using specific types of hashtags. So I started to look at the hashtags that were being uploaded. And when you have a look at the latest material that was uploaded on those hashtags, there are a lot of tourism adverts and really good news about West Papua. And it was completely contrary to the footage I was seeing of huge clashes happening and Indonesian security forces attacking locals and this sort of really quite aggravated clash. And then you've got next to it, under the same hashtag, such as West Papua genocide, adverts about how great West Papua is and how people should visit West Papua and how beautiful it is and how peaceful it is. And it was really contrary. And so I started to have a look at the accounts that were uploading these videos. And just by a simple image reverse search, I noticed that most of the accounts were using profile pictures of K-pop stars. So I started to get an idea of how these accounts were working. And I thought to myself, okay, well, if all of these accounts are uploading this content using specific hashtags, maybe we can do a network analysis. And so I used a really cool open source and freely available application called Gephi. And I streamed all of the tweets that were being uploaded about this hashtag. I noticed that of all the content that was being uploaded, a large majority of it was being uploaded by these bot accounts. And they're quite different to normal human accounts on Twitter, because when someone uploads a picture of, say, a coffee, their friends will retweet it and like it, and it's a central node or a person in the middle and their friends surrounding them in an equal circle. But these were bots that were working in a very weird way, in a very weird manner. So I was able to do a bot network detection, which it sounds really cool, but it was actually quite easy to spot and it was quite fun to spot. But there was a serious side to it as well, because there's human rights atrocities that are happening in West Papua, and yet these bots are promoting pro-government propaganda and material. I went a step further and I started to have a look at Facebook, for instance, and the account, these Twitter accounts were actually linking to websites and Facebook accounts and YouTube accounts. It was funny because I noticed that these same accounts on Facebook were running Facebook ads. So I did a huge Twitter thread and I did a post on Bellingcat about it. Later, Facebook actually did an announcement where they did a takedown of all of these accounts, and they counted how much advertising revenue was spent to advertise this stuff in places like Europe, the US, UK. There was $300,000 spent in ads on these campaigns, providing propaganda about West Papua.
Can you just quickly explain what do you mean by image reverse search?
Sure. So an image reverse search, I use Yandex image reverse search. And basically it's a machine-based learning operation where you can put in an image and it will crawl the internet to find any similar images. So all I would have to do is to save someone's profile image like yours, Laurent, and I would run it through Yandex, which is a great image reverse search engine. And it would show me other places where that image or similar images would have been uploaded. So I might be able to find, you know, your Facebook profile mm-hmm. or your Twitter profile. Yeah. Or
so what was your assessment? Why were they using these bot networks to spread propaganda?
I guess it was to skew the image of what was happening. So to follow on with that investigation, we actually carried through a formal investigation through the BBC using on-ground journalists as well. So it was great to see that fusion between open source and investigative journalism. We spoke to one of the people that we eventually identified through open source. We had local journalists speak to one of the people that was actually behind the automated campaigns. And he said that there was so much foreign news and negative reporting about West Papua that he wanted to balance the side in favour of Indonesia's interests. And it was that self-nationalism and that pride that he had in his country that he wanted to promote good news about Indonesia rather than the truth.
So, Ben, what is your main driver for uncovering these questions?
My main driver is essentially curiosity. And when I was a little boy, I used to grow up watching Tintin. And it was one of my favourite TV shows. And it was so cool to watch him and his little dog, Snowy. And he'd find these clues about when he's investigating something huge, something international. But he would spot these little clues. And in each clue, he would assess what's happening with that clue, where it fits into a narrative. And then he would pivot on that clue or on that new piece of information he found. And he would investigate further and further until he would get to the bottom of something. He's essentially what we do in open source as well. We follow the digital breadcrumbs to find who stole the cookie or who stole the loaf of bread. And for me, that's the biggest thing, is that it's that essential curiosity. And that's probably the most important tool that I would say for anyone to have in open source as well, is curiosity.
So, Ben, another question would be around mental health, which has become a major concern for, especially for many practitioners who view terrorist material online. When you work on these investigations, such as Anatomy of a Killing, Sudan Secret Hit Squads, you also come across, most likely, violent material. So how do you go about, or how do you deal with this type of material?
I guess for investigators, when you're looking at a video, you're often paying attention and you know what's going to be in the video. I think it's the videos in your news feed that when you scroll through the news feed first thing in the morning while you're having your coffee, and suddenly there may be something like a beheading, for instance, or someone that's killed in a very gruesome way through jihadist content, you have a certain reaction to it, a certain shock, because you're not expecting it. And it's something called vicarious trauma. There's very little research in the field so far, especially when it comes to media. And it's not really spoken about in newsrooms either, because the thing is, if you're susceptible to vicarious trauma, it's like it's like the bear on the back of PTSD as well. If you say that you're affected by this content, well, your boss is probably going to think, okay, wow, maybe we should stop that person from looking at this content. But there are certain ways around it. If you have a look online, Amnesty International has done some work about providing guides for this, for instance. So having a look, watching the videos on your phone rather than a full screen or a minimized, window on your computer, watching it without the volume, sometimes watching it in black and white as well. It's these things that take it a step away from reality to make you aware that you're only watching content and that you're not absorbed into the content. It's something that's growing in the industry, is this talk of vicarious trauma, and it's quite real and it has real effects.
So we are currently also organising a webinar together with the GIFCT especially on mental health for content moderators. So if any of the listeners is interested in joining us, please visit our website, techagainstterrorism.org, for more information and how you can sign up for this free webinar. So Ben, thank you so much for taking the time and sharing your expertise with us. It was really interesting to see how you use open source intelligence in a very different context. Creating genuine impact is one of your key drivers or motivations. And it's really good to see that people like yourselves are doing amazing work in this field, uncovering atrocities around the world using only a laptop and a decent internet connection. So thank you very much for joining us. And for our listeners, also make sure to follow Ben on Twitter. His handle is @BenDoeBrown. Thank you, Ben.
Thank you very much, Lauren. Great work. Maybe if I can say one more thing, is for anyone that is listening, please do join the Twitter community and please do take part in the community. There's a lot of really, really friendly people. Everyone's approachable and open source. And no matter how many followers someone has, everyone will respond.
Thank you, Ben. Now let's talk to Terry Patar. Terry runs the intelligence unit at Jane's, and he has been involved in open source intelligence for over 10 years now. Welcome and thank you for joining us, Terry.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So to kick off, how do you use OSINT at Jane's?
Well, we use OSINT in a lot of contexts. Thinking specifically about the kind of things you guys are interested in terms of terrorism, for us, the OSINT is used in our products. So we have certain products like Jane's Terrorism and Insurgency Center, where we're collating terrorism-related events from around the world on a daily basis, and it's hundreds of events each day. And we're then using that to produce analysis based on looking at what are the patterns, the trends, the outliers, all of the interesting things you can get when you've got a large data set that you're able to then look at and see how is the threat of terrorism changing worldwide. Beyond that, we've got, alongside it, militant propaganda analysis, where some of our subject matter experts are really busy each day analysing what militants groups are posting online and the kind of narratives that they're exploiting, that they're trying to use to help bring people to their cause, etc. And just, again, looking at trends in that, how it's changing over time and what are the new topics, etc., that they're using. And then within the team that I work in, so we respond to specific tasking from our national security and government customers. So for us, open source intelligence is really tied to specific questions that we get from RFIs, etc. And that could be on anything relating to security issues. So it's sort of looking at terrorism in the broader context quite often. So we've written quite lengthy reports for some of our government customers on terrorism financing and looking at sort of the activities of groups, etc. And it's changed based on the needs of those customers over the years.
Great. So in terms of the sources you use, how do you gather information in the first place?
It's a good question. So with something like the products, it's done with a combination of automated methods using web crawlers, etc., to gather information from specific sites, a lot of new sites, for example. And then there's the manual aspect also of people knowing which sources are particularly useful for looking at particular events in specific regions. And a lot of it is then also the verification that's involved in that. So at Jane's, we won't treat an event as having necessarily happened unless we've got three independent sources confirming that it's happened. Occasionally, you will have events that are so significant that we might include them on the basis of a single source, but we will caveat that. And we will specifically say this is from a source which we haven't been able to corroborate. So corroboration is an important aspect of what we do. And one of the big, elements of the Jane's way of doing open source intelligence that's been part of, you know, the DNA of the company for over 100 years is making sure that we're providing assured, verified information. You know, we're not just putting out information on the basis of one or two sources, but actually we're sure that these things have happened. So That's sort of the core to the collection aspect of what we do, you know, is that inbuilt verification. For the specific projects that we work on in my team, it tends to be a combination of online research, but also bringing in experts for specific topics who lend their analysis expertise to specific questions that we have. So it could be people who maybe have particular language skills or a focus on a particular region or on a particular group and can really help advise us or lead out some of our research or provide some analysis on the basis of what they're doing. So that could be academics, it could be journalists, it could be ex-government employees. We have a pretty wide network of over sort of 600 experts around the world who we can pull from. You know, they're also regularly contributing to other Jane's products, Jane's Intelligence Review magazine, for example. And then we'll draw them in for our particular projects that we work on.
And how do you turn that information into actionable intelligence, and what analytical methods are applied to this?
Yeah, that's interesting. So one of the things that we really focus on is open source intelligence not just being a collection discipline. And for us, it really is about answering those questions, and it's about answering the requirements and providing, as you said, actionable intelligence. You know, how do we give somebody something that they can then make a decision on? That's really the basis of our reporting and the research and analysis that we provide. And, you know, in terms of methods, a lot of it is down to making sure that all our team are very good critical thinkers as a baseline. You know, you've got to be good at understanding your evidence and the nature of your evidence, understanding the gaps and the assumptions that you have to make and the conclusions that you draw from that. We use also occasionally some structured analysis methods. So quite often the research or the open source intelligence we're producing is directed towards more estimative intelligence. So kind of the answering the what next question and the so what question. So what does it mean for our customer, whoever's reading that report? And usually in terms of especially things like terrorism threats, how do we see it developing in the next 6 months, 1 year, 2 years, etc.? Sometimes, especially on the more defense-oriented or military-oriented side of our work, it's looking at time frames up to sort of 20 years out, because that's the sort of time frames that often our customers are planning for. So we'll use things like scenario analysis. We do a lot of scenario analysis to try and help them work out what are the different potential futures that they might see and what sort of threats they might have to plan for. We do a lot of wargaming as well. So we'll run sort of quite, well, actually really interesting wargaming sessions. So we do one at the moment each year on, or have done for the last 5 years, on what's going to happen over the next 12 months in the Syrian conflict, where we bring together a group of experts on the subject, and we'll workshop it for a day or a couple of days in a wargame format. So really interesting exercises, trying to draw out some creative thinking around the analysis as well. So not just sort of the straight line analysis or trend analysis, but going beyond that sort of analysis that you might produce if you're just an individual working on your own. When you're able to get those different viewpoints and perspectives in a room, it really helps you expand upon your analysis.
And I think that goes to show what a vital role OSINT plays strategically as well. So in terms of the strategy and how OSINT fits into the other intelligence disciplines, how do you see that changing?
Well, I think it's something that's been talked about probably for the last 20 years in terms of the clients that we predominantly deal with, being, you know, national security and government clients. They've all been trying to do more with open source intelligence, or at least they've been talking about doing more with open source intelligence. And that's been emphasized recently. You know, we've heard from senior leaders at the UK Ministry of Defence, at US CENTCOM, that they want to switch around the old paradigm of probably having 80% of their information coming from the other disciplines and only 20% from open source intelligence, to now having perhaps 80% from open source intelligence, because they see it as having expanded so much they can get a lot more from it. I think that that's still something that they're a bit slow to actually put into place in terms of actually putting the resource behind doing open source intelligence properly.
Why do you think that is?
I think that, well, certainly in the old days, you know, open source intelligence was sort of paid lip service to. You know, teams would have maybe a terminal in the corner of the room that they could go online with, and somebody would be allowed to access it to do some online research, and that would be it. And now I think they realize that actually you've got to really professionalize in this discipline. You've got to have dedicated teams that are working on this, but you've also got to spread out the capability across all the analysts and make it part of their workflow. So they understand that open source intelligence is just as important as some of the other types of information they're getting or intelligence they're getting from other disciplines. It's also, I think, a reflection of how open source intelligence has changed, in the sense that there's just so much more information available now, and there's so much more you can do with it. It's not anymore the preserve of, I think in the past you'd have information specialists, what we used to call librarians, I guess, who would do the open source intelligence, and they're all, you know, fantastic experts. They're really, really good researchers. They know exactly how to get information, but then they didn't necessarily have the expertise to exploit things like foreign language content or to use satellite imagery. And there's so much more commercial satellite imagery available now that an open source intelligence team should really have imagery analysts embedded within it. And data, you know, having data scientists, there's so many data sets out there now, or there's so much information that you can combine and collate into data sets, that you need to have those expertise within the OSINT team, which means that the OSINT team goes from being in its own little silo on one side of the organization to actually being in the center of what an intelligence organization is doing.
And I was going to ask about that. I mean, how do you see OSINT analysts being integrated with the technology that's required to generate and collect that, and also with the data technologies and data science required to understand such a vast amount of information?
Yeah, so I think that the capabilities they need involve not only upskilling them in some ways or adding in experts to those teams, but also helping them understand what's possible, the art of the possible. So from our perspective at Jane's, we're trying to produce sometimes analysis or intelligence that we can show to our customers to say, you know, have you thought about doing things this way? Or have you thought about drawing in this type of information and producing this kind of analysis? So trying to do things that are maybe a little bit more novel that they haven't yet started to do, to give them ideas on what else can be done. You know, there are certain advantages that we have in not being a government organization. Sometimes it's easier for us to reach out to experts, as I said, and you know, draw in expert comments, etc., from people around the world, which sometimes it's harder for government agencies to do, or to go out and interview people. You know, we have journalists in-house who can go and do that. But yeah, I think it's about educating people so they understand what you can do now with open source intelligence. And it's a lot more than you were able to do in the past. So they do need to have the right processes in place. They need to have the right technology. They need to have the right skills and expertise.
So if you had to give one recommendation to governments, what would it be?
Narrowing it down to one is difficult. It would probably be to rethink how they do open source intelligence currently and to resource it properly. So think about how they can get more out of it and actually not just have it as a peripheral element of what they do, but really put it into the center of all of the intelligence work that's being done. Because there's so much more value that they can get from doing things that way around, rather than just sort of tasking an open source intelligence team whenever there's something that comes up from other disciplines where they think, actually, we need some additional information here, or we need to water down a classified assessment and have an open source version of it that we can easily share, which I think up to now has probably been the mindset. So it's really having a mindset and culture shift around how open source intelligence is done and how it's used.
Well, certainly at Tech Against Terrorism, OSINT is fundamental to what we do, because we want to understand first and foremost where terrorists and violent extremists are operating on the internet, how they are using technologies, and then what can be done about it. In our case, it's sometimes quite hard to understand who is running particular platforms as well, and then how to reach out to them. That's a real challenge. Something that we think is really important here is to try to encourage greater coordination and collaboration. For example, we know that where the Christchurch terrorist attack is concerned, that was signalled online quite far in advance. And especially where violent far-right extremist attacks are concerned, we often find that the terrorist or perpetrator talks about this online beforehand. But it seems really hard for governments to coordinate OSINT around this.
It does. And I think, you know, you've picked on an interesting example there. And it's one where I think it highlights that policy for government and law enforcement agencies in some countries probably needs to adapt and change. To allow them to do more with open source intelligence. But they, you know, and it would be interesting to get your viewpoints on this, but in terms of tracking terrorist activity and tracking that kind of content, I think for some of the national security government law enforcement agencies we deal with, it goes beyond the threshold of what is open source intelligence. Because once you're at the stage where you're having to use perhaps fake profiles on social media or actually creating personas to stay on these kinds of platforms for a longer period of time to gather that sort of information, or to be alerted, you know, when that sort of information pops up, that kind of for them goes beyond what is open source intelligence.
So I mean, when does it go from OSINT to HUMINT?
It's an interesting question. I think different organizations define it differently. You know, we deliver a lot of open source intelligence training at Jane's, and that's one of the sort of main areas of responsibility I've held over the last 10 years. And one of the things I always start off doing at the beginning of each course is saying to people, okay, how do we define open source intelligence? And you do get differences of opinion. You know, you've got a generic definition. We're producing intelligence on the basis of publicly available information. But how do you define what's publicly available? You know, if you've got to log into something, for some people, that's the point at which actually, no, it goes beyond open source. Now you're into the area of, you know, somebody else. It's somebody else's responsibility to do that. You know, you'll have maybe a specialist who does that kind of work. For others, it's fine to log into something, to have maybe a profile that they use that just to be for the purposes of logging into maybe a social media platform. And after that point, it's, you know, if you are then having to engage at any stage, that's when it then drifts into being more online human intelligence rather than open source intelligence.
I mean, that's an interesting point. At Tech Against Terrorism, we're committed to, or in the full title of our work is tackling the terrorist use of the internet whilst respecting human rights. And the second part of that phrase is really important to us, that in fighting terrorism online, we support the values and principles that we think are important in democracies. And I guess this also applies to OSINT.
Mm. Oh, definitely. I think people have to be aware of the legal aspects of it, the ethical aspects as well, of collecting information on people online. You know, at some point you have to ask yourself the question, just because it's online, does it make it open source intelligence, or, you know, open source information rather, or is it something that goes beyond that? You know, and for us, for example, we might not use information that comes from leaked government documents, for example, whereas other people might do. In different organizations that we work with, you know, especially within the UK, they might stick to policy definitions. So, you know, UK law enforcement agencies have their five different levels of that apply to online research, because at some point it might become surveillance. And so they apply their sort of surveillance definitions to doing online work, in which case it's got to go through the right process of approvals. It's got to be in line with all the legislation and policy that they have in place to do that. And it's got to respect people's privacy. It's got to respect people's human rights, as you know, you guys also do as well. So, yeah, there's, I think for every organization, they've got to define it for themselves and make sure that people are doing the research within the correct parameters. But I think also, you know, where people are investigating terrorist content or terrorist activity online, they've got to start thinking about, okay, actually, do we need to think about online human intelligence and doing that in adjacent to your open source intelligence?
Mm. Certainly we focus on trying to understand what terrorists want to achieve and what their objectives are, and our analysis is that for the most part it's about trying to promote their ideology. Mm-hmm. Try to get kind of renown, build up reputation, etc.
Yeah, I think there's probably enough content out there that's openly available that it gives you a great sort of data set that you can work from to analyse and answer specific questions that, you know, you're trying to address.
So how do you deal with this sort of intelligence conundrum that in surfacing terrorist content, we could be making it easier for other terrorists and people vulnerable to radicalization to get hold of that? And certainly that's a real challenge that we find. Even publicizing a platform that we come across, we have to think long and hard about, because we often worry that in discussing some of these things, we could actually inadvertently be supporting the very challenge. So how do you deal with the challenge at Jane's that actually by discussing these issues, you could be kind of feeding into the problem?
I mean, that's definitely a challenge when it comes to analysing militant propaganda or extremist content online. And for us, you know, we're very careful about where we publish things and how we publish it and who it's published to and who reads our content. But at some point, yeah, you do have to flag these things up, or you do have to start discussing them openly, because if we were just working on it in isolation, we might not be aware of the wider context, or if we're not sharing information with other people, we might not be able to connect together what others are doing on looking at the same kind of platforms. So there's also that element of coordination, and actually by putting it out there, we can start having that conversation and start having that conversation in the open about, well, this is actually a really important problem that's, you know, maybe bubbling up, that if somebody doesn't address this platform or start looking at it in more detail, maybe it's government, law enforcement agencies, etc., it could cause some bigger problems further down the line. So at some point, you know, you reach a threshold where you've got to actually bring these issues out into the open and start discussing them. But yeah, I take your point. I mean, one of the things we're wary of is not doing that too early and then just attracting more support and more attention for these kinds of platforms.
Fantastic. Thanks very much, Terry.
No problem. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Tech Against Terrorism podcast. If you'd like to learn more about our work, please visit our website, techagainstterrorism.org, and follow us on Twitter for updates. You can find us at Tech versus Terrorism. Once again, thank you to our guests, Benjamin, Nico, and Terry. We'll be back soon with another episode.